You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us.
On today's podcast, we have the opportunity to sit down with Mike Leister of TacticalWoodGas.com. He specializes in alternative energy solutions for rural, off-grid, and emergency power needs. Great interview. Got a chance to pick his brain on many different topics. Obviously, we concentrate on what he's got going on with his wood gasifier systems and other products and other really cool projects that he has coming up that he's been working on based on what customers have given him as far as feedback. Really cool interview, and I was privileged to be able to sit down with him and talk. Before we get started on that interview, I want to talk to you briefly about what we have coming up here on Sovereign Sunrise Permafarm. We've got these two workshops coming up that I've plugged before, and we've still got some slots available, so I just want to talk about it real quick. June 13th and July 18th of this year, just a one-day seminar on basically an introduction to homesteading. We come at it from a pretty unique perspective with permaculture and preparedness as our backdrop. So join us for that, or help us spread the word on our workshops coming up. We cover all aspects. It's a really good overview of homesteading. You know, we talk about why people homestead and how you're supposed to, you need to keep that in mind as you go forward. We talk about changing your mindset when it comes to homesteading and choosing land and methods to work that land. Some unique perspectives on our workshop, establishing a food forest for sustainability, the ultimate sustainability, really. Annuals versus perennials. Obviously, we tend towards perennials systems. Doesn't mean we don't have annuals. We have lots of annuals. How much to plan and what, and how to kind of plan that out when you're trying to, say, feed your family 80%, okay, or more. We do a walking tour of our permafarm, so we hit all different aspects. We have like 8 stations that we'll talk about. So, for example, you know, how we run our chickens and why we do it that way. How to choose livestock, small livestock versus large livestock, and how your land will dictate some of those things. But how small livestock has an advantage for the preparedness-minded person. If you want to go down the dairy route, cows versus goats. We also do a demonstration, growing and processing your own meat. So we will go through the processing of an animal from dispatch to the freezer, really. Or however you're going to preserve that meat. Which we do go into food preservation methods, fermentation, freezing, dehydrating, canning. And then we finish it up with a goal-setting session for homestead success. This is very important. This is what a lot of people lack in planning and being able to set those goals and to really give you basically a compass azimuth to keep moving down. Okay, very important. This includes a home-prepared meal. So this workshop's going to be great. We're really looking forward to it. So help us spread the word. Now let's get into our interview with Mike. I think you're really going to enjoy this. Mike, thanks for being on the podcast. We really appreciate your time. Why don't we get started and have you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to this point in your life.
Okay. Well, my name is Mike Leister. I started up Tactical Wood Gas to start bringing some of the energy, alternative energy innovations that my brother-in-law and I have been doing to other people, figuring they might need it. But part of it is a little bit of DNA. My dad was a Air Force enlisted and then officer. But he was a city boy, grew up, in the middle of Columbus. And I somehow picked up the you know, go out in the woods, you know, killing and gutting animals, and, you know, hunting and fishing and all that kind of gene from somewhere. And then I was in high school, and one of these rare teachers came along, and he was a civics teacher, and he showed us a graph of the national debt, and it never went down. And I thought, that wouldn't work in my life. It's probably going to end badly. And this is way back in like 1982 or 1983. And so that kind of it set the premise, you know, in my mind that someday, you know, in my lifetime, this is going to end badly. So I should make decisions along the way, you know, not you know, become a hermit and run off into the mountains, but just make the, you know, decisions based on that knowledge. And so I, you know, I thought, well, I don't know what to do for college yet, but I sure would like to have an adventure and pick up some military skills. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps. Semper Fi to you and to all the listeners out there that have been in the Marine Corps or are currently serving.
Absolutely.
You know, came out of that kind of all busted up but you know, happy that I did it and got to do crazy stuff. Went to college, became an engineer, you know, initially defense and space. So I got a bunch of stuff up in the space station and military satellites and then into semiconductors, you know, where I built a career. But at the same time, I was, you know, I had a kind of an entrepreneurial spirit, and I started a small company in 2002, I think. To make LED taillight inserts for street rods. Although initially, because we were doing sand rails, which is a, you know, kind of a fancy dune buggy.
Right.
We're doing it, which is old air-cooled Volkswagen engines and transmissions. We had a passion for that, so we did some LED lights for Volkswagens. And then we discovered, you know, not all markets are equal. And in the Volkswagen crowd, they'll brag that it only took a half a stick of gum to get their carburetor working.
okay.
And, you know, that's not a crowd that's going to finance, you know, a growing company. And a guy at work said, you need to meet the guys who are bragging, you know, that they spend $10,000 or $15,000 on a carburetor. Let me introduce you to the street rod crowd. And, you know, this is the over 50... you know, midlife crisis, you know, you know, they got lots of money to spend. And so a simple circuit board with, you know, some really bright LEDs, and, you know, we're selling them $50 a piece. And that lasted about a year and a half, until, something, basically a copy came out of China, and kind of took, you know, basically cut the money out of that. So we explored a few things and, you know, 5 years later shut it down. But then, you know, got into, you know, more and more serious phase of prepping basically looking for personal liberty. And that, you know, as I went down the, you know, beans, bullets, and Band-Aids, and I was looking around, okay, I've got a lot of my bases covered. I'm training with my stuff. I'm rotating my stock. At that point, I kind of got, when I was in the, I guess a little tangent here, when I was in the Marine Corps, I was at Camp Lejeune in the late 80s when they had heavy metals and other toxins in the water there.
Yes, yes.
You know, as a consequence of that, now I, you know, diabetes came up and bit me in the butt. I've been able to get it under control with diet and exercise, but while I was on insulin, I was like, you know, the worst case scenarios that I was considering, you know, all involve blindness and death if I don't have refrigeration and insulin. So that really pushed energy to the very top of the list, initially with battery banks and then kind of moving on. So I guess I've been talking for a little bit. That's kind of what led me to, you know, into the energy industry. You know, people on a normal budget that are trying to figure out a way to have options both for, you know, 2 week, 3 week power outage while, you know, as a response to, you know, say up in your neck of the woods, maybe, you know, wildfires. taken out power, all the way to, you know, some of the places in the world, and hopefully never here, where, you know, areas of the country that are in open rebellion to federal overstep, you know, some excuse comes up that there's not enough power, and they just shut off power to an area that they don't like.
Right.
You know, you just need to be, you need to have options. You don't ever want to be going to the government with a handout because, you know, you'll get a handcuff on it no matter what it is they're handing to you.
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, you kind of laid the foundation very well. And actually, I didn't know this, but you have a very personal reason why energy is so important to you. And that's great. I'm glad that. And you've obviously got it handled very well, and we're going to talk about some of those things. And that's great. And I am also, I'm of the same mind. I look at our national debt right now, and it's just astronomical. Of course, it's not sustainable. We know that. We don't know how it ends or when it crashes, but it will. I mean, I always like to tell people that the percentage rate for successful countries throughout human history is 0%. So we have to keep that in mind. So I'm glad. Now, you said, just kind of a go off to the side here, you said you have diabetes, and you said you have it under control with diet and exercise. Were you able to get off of insulin?
Yeah, that was I guess, priority number one. You can do an amazing amount of things if you say, you know, everything else takes second to getting this goal done.
Yeah.
You know, when I got it, I mean, I went in the hospital with 600. My blood sugar was sitting right at 600. I got, because of that, I got I was down in San Diego, and it's like the head of the insulin clinic, you know, that is headquartered in San Diego was my doctor, because people don't generally come in that state. Conscious. They've got it under control, and there's weird things that happen when your blood sugar rapidly goes down to normal. The capillaries that swell up change, and so I couldn't read anything. My glasses were useless. I couldn't see anything. I was like, you know, so I kind of got a glimpse of what it might be if I don't really, really get this under control. Plus, I had a lifelong fear of shots. And here I'm presented with the, you know, the case of I'm going to have to give myself a shot four times a day for the rest of my life. So it was, you know, I could barely walk to the end of the block, but I'd walk to the end of the block, and the next day I'd take two more, you know, steps and two more steps and two more steps. And then I also went on just a radically strict diet of you know, fresh and steamed veggies, you know, a medium amount of meat, and I just, you know, whacked out. I had to educate myself on what's a good vegetable and what's a bad vegetable. What's a starch? What's a, you know, you can eat all the yellow squash you want, but the Hubbard squash is full of starches. All these things I had to learn. And I just was extremely strict on that. And I also, I'm an engineer, right? So I made a spreadsheet. And I, you know, it's like every day I was tracking how many units of insulin I was taking. What was a blood sugar? Exactly what did I eat? Oh, this meal didn't work. What was in it? And basically dialed in my food intake, was able to back off the insulin down to where I was off the shots. But then it was like I was struggling really hard to get stuff done with energy. And what I found out is that some of these pills they were giving me were also insulin. And so my blood sugar was abnormally low. It was like 60 or 50 or 40, you know, at that point. And so I, you know, got off those things and kind of bounced back to more normal. And then it's, from that point on, it's just, you know, fear of needles keeps the candy out of my mouth. And fear of not being able to care for my family, to provide for my family.
Awesome. That is really, really cool to hear. I'm glad that you're able to get that under control. We're very passionate about nutrition and health as well, and it's amazing how much our society, our culture, discounts nutrition
with regards to health. It boggles the mind, even in the medical community. Well, maybe especially in the medical community. You kind of explained to us kind of what drove you towards energy, and we kind of saw the genesis of that. But what specifically drove you towards tactical wood gas?
Okay, so my brother-in-law and I, he's been avionics, small plane avionics for decades, and I've been engineering. And engineering, sometimes you have to be flexible on where you live and where you work. And seeing the economic crisis, basically seeing the pop of the housing bubble coming, and the fragility of the company I was working for, I took a much more secure job down in San Diego, but nobody could afford to live down there.
Right.
Especially not toward the end of the housing bubble. So I was, flying back and forth from Washington State a lot. I think Alaska Airlines is still crying for losing me as a customer. but I guess I'm telling that in order to say, I was away a lot. My brother-in-law was away a lot. And both of us, on his farm have cattle and hogs that we slaughter and butcher and process ourselves. And, if it's December and I'm something happens and I can't get back into town and the power goes out, I've got, we'd say amongst the family, we may have $5,000-$10,000 worth of very high quality meat that can go bad.
Right.
And we can't afford to have that happen. And we looked at our wives and said, they're not going to want to pull on the cord on the generator. And any generator that sits there with gas in the carburetor may need some, tweaking to get it going if it hasn't been used for 6 months. So what we did was we built battery banks, and we actually used GC2 golf cart batteries, which are 6-volt, but there's a way to connect them in series to get 12 volts out of it. So we built battery banks and stuck inverters on the top, and we, showed it to our wives, and we said, okay, when the power goes out, unplug the chest freezer, plug it in here, and put the switch up, and as long as I can get back to you in a week and a half, then that's all you got to do. And they liked that, and we liked that. It's, there was a simple solution to that, and we were good with that for about a year and a half, 2 years, and we thought, that's a week and a half is, we'll get back hopefully in time to, start up a generator and make it go. But then we thought, how much gas, can we store? And so the next phase of our energy independence was saying, looking into the generators, and a lot of people out there listening to this are not going to like what comes next. If you own a generator, go and get the operator's manual and read how many hours the engine is rated for. I've worked in India, in Bangalore, where the power goes out, 6-7 times a day. 6-7 times a day at a high-tech company. And basically every store has a generator sitting out front to deal with that, especially if they have perishable goods. So the generators in the U.S. are designed for the U.S. power grid, which you may use the thing, 3 weekends, 4 weekends, in 5 years. Most of them are rated for 100 hours or less. So we thought that's not, good enough for us. Plus, we're trying to charge a little, battery bank, and we don't need 5 kilowatts, 10 kilowatts. We're not going to power up the whole house. We want enough to charge up our needs, not our wants. So we took a little three-horse gas engine, hooked it up to an alternator, a car alternator, and just made a super efficient charging system for our battery bank. The problem with the big generators is if you're going to charge a little battery bank like we've got, when you have a very light load on those big generators, it draws nearly as much gas as it does under a much heavier load. Spinning that big AC head on those generators is quite a bit. So it takes quite a bit of energy. So we did that, and we were pretty happy with that. But there's always the, you got to have a backup plan, and then, a backup plan, and then what do you, what's your backup plan?
Right.
And we said, you know, what if, you know, either through choice, because we have the opportunity to go way off grid, or no choice, where the grid becomes, you know, really unreliable for a long time, and gasoline is either, you know, it's unaffordable, the quality is low, the government needs it all for the war effort, or, you know, could that not happen? You know, people on ration cards in World War II. So what do we do then? And so then we did some research and finally found a guy in the energy business, or say in the energy education business, and bought a book on wood gas. And I spent a year and a half reading that thing. And the instructions were there, but I couldn't get my head around building something that can power a full-size pickup truck when I want to spin something that's going to put out 2 kilowatts of power. You know, something that, you know, where the wood gas system is, you know, 10 times the size of the generator that I'm trying to run. I wanted something that I could pack up and run, with. And, so we basically, I studied it to the point that I was able to understand basically how everything worked, why everything was in there. And we scaled the thing down to where we had a wood gas generator system that you could lift up and carry. And to my knowledge, as far as commercially available systems, that doesn't exist, other than what we've got. Everything else out there, you know, if it's assembled and ready to work, you need a pallet jack or a forklift to lift the thing and move it around. So that's what we ended up with. And we refined it for a couple of years. And finally we said, you know, there's so many videos of people experimenting with it, and they're all, you know, they've got something on a giant cart that runs their little generator. And knowing what it takes to experiment as far as cost and what you throw away, and, you know, unless you've got access to a junkyard in the backyard, it'd cost more to develop what we have than just for someone to buy it, even with profit left over for us. So we decided to launch Tactical Wood Gas and focus it around, you know, home-sized generators for remote cabins and you know, there's people like we installed one in eastern Oregon, south of the Dalles. That's generic enough, I guess.
Right.
To, you know, where the person lives, you know, 10 miles past where power stops. And they had a decent battery bank, but they looked at how many solar cells it took to get any amount of charging on those batteries, and the cost of that, and what do you do on cloudy days and what do you do at night. You know, they were very happy with that solution. And that was, she was like 7 years old, and she handled the system just perfectly. She took to the training and was able to operate the thing by herself. You know, a day after we installed it, ran through all the training.
Very cool. Hey, can you tell us just very briefly, just how does it work? I mean, you know, if somebody's sure. Like they're listening to you, they say tactical wood gas fire. How does it work in a nutshell?
Okay. In a nutshell, and this is something that I couldn't find. So this is, you know, based on me interpreting kind of everything that's out there. So on the highest level, instead of putting gasoline in, you put wood in and you get electricity out. And that's if you've got the whole system end to end. On a piece by piece case, how it works is you take very dry chipped wood. And that's important. If it's got moisture in it, it's not going to work very well, and it's going to gum up a tire. So, you know, really, really dry chipped wood, or, you know, we've done dried cherry pits, even wood pellet stove pellets. Anyway, that goes in a hopper, and it's got a little restricted top on the top where only a little bit of air can come in. It's about a 3-inch circle where air can come in. And you light it on the bottom. There's a way to do that. You light the wood on the bottom. And the wood catches fire and burns up to a certain size. And the size is limited by how much air can get through that little hole at the top.
Right.
So initially use a fan to push the air through, but later on use the generator or the engine to pull the air through the system. So a certain amount of air is coming in. It gets down to the bottom of the wood where it keeps that fire going a certain size. That heat cooks the wood above it, some of which comes down and combines with the oxygen and burns and keeps the fire going, some of which there's no oxygen to pair with. So that hydrogen, methane, CO passes straight through the fire unburned because there's no oxygen for it to pair with.
Right.
So you end up with this extra gas that's useful to you. And that goes out of the reactor, that we call it, and passes in a pipe through to the cooler. And so right now you've got kind of sooty, dirty wood gas. And you want clean wood gas. So to get all the tar out, all the creosote, the stuff that, causes chimney fires and all that, we pass it through our cooling chamber. And the cooling chamber is like an inside-out radiator where the wood gas passes through a metal chamber with some passages and ducting and stuff, and it touches the metal and passes the heat into the metal.
Okay.
Well, the outside of the metal is water jacketed, so it's got a big thermal mass for that heat to go into. So the cooler basically extracts the heat out. When you condense, when you cool down something with vapors in it, the vapors condense against the metal, just like when you take a really cold glass of iced tea and you stick it out on a humid day, it basically moisture gathers on the outside.
Right.
It's the same idea. So this stuff collects against the sides and runs downhill. And out of the cooler and downhill into a tar trap. And it really is very much like crude oil. And I'll get back to that because that's actually kind of fun.
Okay.
So at that point, you've got the tar out. So you've got clean gas, but you don't have the particles. You may have some ash burp through. You may have, basically you want to get particles out. So at that point, it goes through a particle filter. And for that, you can use shredded toilet paper. We love that gerbil pet bedding that they sell at the pet stores.
Right.
But you could use fleece. You could use, anything kind of furry that would trap the particles. And at that point, you're ready to go. That is wood gas. It's been cleaned and cooled and filtered. And you mix it 50-50 with outside air and run a gas engine.
Got it. Okay. I'm looking at the picture of it now, and you explained it really well. So once it goes into the wood gas cooler, you said it collects down there to the exhaust port. Is that where it connects in to the engine itself?
So I've described, in simple terms, the chemical processes that are going on.
Right.
So in practical, how do you do this? There's an ignition port where you unscrew a cap and you stick a little lighter in there and you light the wood at the bottom. There's also a test port. What you want to do is get the fire going, but initially you're just going to get smoke. You're not going to get wood gas until that fire builds up to the point that it's cooking off extra gases for you. And so the fan pushes that through and you open up the valve for the test port and basically smoke comes out of there and eventually it's going to go from like solid white to more translucent. And that means that the fire has gotten hot enough and big enough to do the pyrolysis, process and create those gases you want. So when you can light the wood gas coming out of the test port, and it stays lit, that means you're gasifying and you're ready to use it in the engine. So then you turn off that test port and you open the valve that lets it go through to the engine. We do it, the test port, just before the filter, so that we don't get the filter media all soggy. Because initially, it's really sitting smoky and wet until that fire gets big enough. So you want the test port before you go through your filter media.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's just like burning through a wood stove or a rocket mass heater or anything like that. The initial, until you get that heat up, it's not going to be working properly.
Right.
Yep. Now, you mentioned the tar trap. What can you do with that?
So there's this guy named, he calls himself Mr. Teslosian. And he's basically a desert hillbilly chemist. And that sounds like a really dangerous combination. But he's not doing crazy things. What he's experimenting with, what can you do with this, you know, wood gas, and what can you do with the leftover tar? And after he's done a run for wood gas, he'll go and he'll collect that stuff back up. What we're doing is we're condensing it out all in one stage, because our priority is just to get it out. And what he does is he takes what's collected in that jar and he sticks it in a metal can and he sticks it above a rocket stove and he re-vaporizes it. And what he does is he runs it through, some copper pipe and down through, a coffee pot with some water in it, and some condensers there. And then it runs through another one and then a paint can, and he runs it through, he basically breaks it down into like 15 stages of cooling. And when you do that, the first stage still looks like, thick tar. The second stage looks like a thick motor oil. The third stage is a lighter motor oil. The fourth stage is like a cutting oil for machining. Then really light oils. And at the very, the very end, before you just can't get anything else out, is actually wood alcohol. So he cracks it like they do on the refineries, and ends up with all those useful things. And I thought, that is just the neatest thing, because one thing to making an engine last longer is changing the oil.
Right.
But what if the oil that you're using to change every 10 hours of operation on your generator is wood oil that you've generated through this very same process that you're using?
That's awesome. You're stacking the functions of the machine.
Yeah. So we haven't come up with a kit for doing that. When I say a hillbilly chemist, I say that respectfully.
Sure.
The guy knows a lot more than me regarding, the physics and the chemistry of what he's doing with cracking that into the various pieces and how to test them and all that kind of stuff. But at least for personal experimentation, that's in the future sometime when I'll find some time to do that. Right now, I just I stick it in a 55-gallon drum and keep on collecting it.
Gotcha. Okay.
And at some point, I'll figure this stuff all out, and I'll have a backlog of material to use for experimenting.
Ah, very cool. That's awesome. Hey, I see that you work in rocket mass heaters as well. Was that a spinoff, or is that something that you've been into for quite some time?
It was a spinoff. Say 3 years ago. My brother-in-law, he's the one that has the farm in Spokane that we do the animals on. He spends $300 a month on propane heating plates, and he rents the propane pig that sits on his property, and then that means that people have to come onto his property, And look around and see all the stuff, all the resources he's got. So we thought, it'd be better not to have that.
Yeah.
But he knew that, wood stoves are pretty good, but they're not as efficient as they could be. And because of all the reading we've done, we heard about these things. So he tried it out, and it worked incredible. He recouped his investment in 4 months on the first winter.
Wow.
It took him probably another 6 months for his back to recover from lifting all that rock. But, I'm just joking, Kelly. I didn't mean that. I know he's going to listen to this one. Actually, Kelly's pretty strong. And he can, he's got pain tolerance that most people cannot understand. But you've got, if it's a 5,000 pound thing, that means you're moving 5,000 pounds of that stuff and move it here, move it there, adjust it. There's a lot of work involved with that. So, the nice thing about that is you test it, and there's like, there's a little bit of water vapor that comes out. The nice thing about it too is, like, if you've got a wood stove and you're burning wood to keep warm, if there's no wind going at all, you've got a plume of smoke that goes up in the air that says, there's an inhabited dwelling here. With this stuff, it burns so hot, it's the opposite end of the spectrum from wood gas. Wood gas, you starve it of oxygen and you maximize the byproducts. On a rocket mass heater, you burn it so hot that you burn the smoke. Even the smoke burns. And so when you get a little bit of water vapor out. And so we'd go out in different weather, freezing weather, and we'd run outside and we'd look at the what's coming out of the chimney, and there'd be about maybe 10 feet of vapor before it cooled down and condensed and basically disappeared. So you run the thing, you maybe get 10 or 15 minutes of some wood smoke, but after that there's none. And so your signature for people who are scanning the area looking around is very low. It gives you a low profile. And with cord and a half of wood in north of Spokane, Washington, where you can get pretty darn cold, cord and a half of wood kept the house really warm, like 70, 75 degrees all winter long.
That's phenomenal. So, yeah, I've done quite a bit of research on rocket mass heaters and rocket mass stoves, and every time, and we have some really efficient wood stoves here, and our primary heat, or our primary heating is wood. But every time I look up, and especially when you first get a wood stove going, you're watching all that fuel and smoke just go away, and it's really nice to have an efficient burn happening in your wood stove, and I love that. But I know I'm just burning through, twice what you just mentioned in cords, at least over a winter. So yeah, I'm very interested in this.
Yeah, for safety, that's by design. They require the who is it? I can't remember what government agency it is, but. They require the exit temperature of your exhaust to be, I think, above 600 degrees. And the reason for that is the tars don't condense out, at those temperatures. And so the tars are carried out and you don't have a chimney fire. So there's a safety reason if you have a wood stove for why it is, not as efficient. You can't have that kind of efficiency without having chimney fires. Well, the thing with the rocket mass heater is you can think of it as a constant chimney fire where the all of the creosote is burning in the heat riser all the time.
Right. Right. Yeah, because I clean out my flues twice a year on both of them. So
Yeah. Now we're not a contractor, and I know in Portland, Oregon, they've got some codes on rocket mass heaters, but most of the country has no idea how to deal with them and try to apply wood stove codes to it, which don't make sense because the chemistry is different. How the burn happens is different.
Yeah.
So we're not a contractor, and in most places, if you're doing these things, you're doing them just basically under the radar. It's my business. I'm doing what I want on my land. And if I have trouble when I sell the place, that's, I'll deal with that.
So, yeah, absolutely.
For that reason, we offer consulting and education. So as an educational service on the rocket mass heaters, You know, we're not responsible for, you know, the city, you know, showing up and saying, that's an unlicensed wood stove. You know, we can't be, you know, we can't be liable for that. So, right. So we offer educational and consulting services so that you do it right, because there's ways to do it wrong that are dangerous.
Yeah, no, you're right. Absolutely. And this is an area that I've been researching for quite some time and plan to move forward eventually, and you know, once I get my ducks in a row. But I really relate to the whole the cooking as well, and with the propane and all of that, because that's, you know, our primary gas, of course. But you know, there's the simple fact of maybe even just building kind of an outdoor kitchen with a small rocket stove, which would be very efficient. You know, you wouldn't have to heat up your house that way. There's all kinds of benefits. Hey, tell us about your kind of your line of products. You just mentioned, you know, consulting and education in the area of rocket mass heaters, and of course, you know, your wood gasifier. What else are you doing?
Okay, so we started out with the wood gas, and a lot of people would say that's interesting, but I don't get the whole big picture. So when we're doing the shows, we thought, you know, We had taken some engines and proved that these things would run engines. So we came up with our own design for the little three horse gas engine, you know, previously. So we extended that to the three fuel wood gas, propane or natural gas generator. So you can get and we bumped it up to 6.5 horse. So we've got 6.5 horse generators that can run wood gas, propane, and natural gas.
Wow, that's awesome.
Then let's see, we've got battery banks, and this is one of the things that people it's this progressive thing where we progressive is a bad word, I guess. It's this evolving thing where we've got, you know, we show the wood gas, how we're generating the useful gases. We show it connected to the carburetor of the generator. And then we needed to show that the generator output connects to the battery bank. And people would ask us questions and just walk away confused with how to put together a simple battery bank. And we looked at it and said, we can add some value, and we can also, you know, kind of, we can get people to dip their toe into energy independence with a product that makes things super simple. And what we did is we put together a battery box that has built onto the top of it a triple charger, a smart triple charger that will not cook up your batteries. And, you know, a smart triple charger that will treat your battery, basically that will maximize the life of your battery.
Right.
Keep it charged up, maximize the life of your battery, combined with an 800-watt power inverter. And so what we do is we sell these things, and people, and it's got the instructions right on the side, even how to buy a battery. You know, you want a 12-volt battery, you want deep cycle, you want at least 100 amp hours of capacity. If they don't show amp hours of capacity, then it's probably not a good number. It's probably not a good battery, and so they don't want to show. If it's 100 amp hours or better capacity, and that's basically how much work it can do, they'll tell you. The deep cycle RV marine batteries, they're all listed like that. I know Walmart has one that I like that's 122 amp hours. You basically sit the battery in there. There's a red lead. You bolt it on, and the batteries come with the nut. You bolt it on to the positive. There's a black lead. You bolt it on to the negative. You snap the lid on, and you plug the thing in the well, and you're done. And it'll sit there and stay maximum charged all the time. And when your power goes out, it's sitting there at 100% capacity. And you know, we use them to keep the brood lights going on for the chickens, for the chicks. We'll, you know, one of the kids, you know, will call my brother-in-law and say, you know, I'm in the apartment and I've got no power, and say, well, come on over and grab one, and they'll come over and grab a, you know, one of these things and bring it back and keep their refrigerator going, you know, or, you know, there's different. I mean, one of the most used, I guess, the highest uses of these things is for the kids. You know, they're bouncing off the walls, nothing works, and you can power a TV and a DVD player, and they'll sit down in front of that, and the world is good. If they can, you know, watch their DVD, it doesn't matter what's going on around them, and so they're you know, kind of plugged into something they enjoy while you're going and checking on the critters and making sure that, you know, the property is secure and that you know, people aren't taking advantage of the power outage, you know, to your disadvantage.
Yeah.
And kids love that. You know, we don't, at my home, we don't have TV. You know, we'll do some Netflix and things like that, but still, it's nice to get that. Especially you got microwave internet out there, right here.
Yes.
Yeah, so being able to run your receiver and you know, any modems and you know, get some Wi-Fi going around the house when the power's out. It, you know, at the transmit station, there may be power over there and just not on your side, and so you get to get a wider view of what's going on around you. You know, the information saves lives for sure.
Yeah, there's something to be said about providing a little bit of normalcy during an emergency or whatever, that gives people a chance. You know, it's like a breather. It's like we're not preparedness minded because we think that's going to solve all of our problems. But when you are prepared, it gives you time to react. And whereas most people won't have any time, it's going to be a huge shock and an emergency for them. It's you know, it's altering. It changes everything about them. Whereas someone who is prepared, it simply has more time to think through the problem and apply solutions.
Yeah. Yeah. Our generation, you know, when things kind of went sideways, if you could still make a cup of coffee, then okay, I've got a little bit of control over my world. Let's see how I can extend that footprint. With the younger generation, it's not coffee. It's, you know, a little bit of technology works. Okay. You know, the world isn't ended. Now let's see what we can do to, you know, get things under better control.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I like to think heavily in terms of, I always have, you know, it's just, maybe it's the military mind, maybe too many years in the Marine Corps, I don't know. But I always think in primary, secondary, and tertiary means of accomplishing tasks. And obviously you have thought through a lot of this. And so how do you view these alternative energy solutions with regards to being preparedness minded? I mean, you have been hinting at it along the way, of course, but maybe you could kind of spell that out for us.
Okay. So, you know, within the power self-sufficiency, you know, arena, I guess, you know, the core of my backup plan is my major battery bank. But, you know, I've got extra ones that are individual batteries, you know, sitting there so that if I, you know, if something goes wrong, something's, you know, discharged, I've got one big and multiple small battery banks. And then I've got, you know, there's multiple ways to power those things. I mean, one thing is in the cars and the trucks and the SUV, you know, an 800 watt inverter and an extension cord means that you could turn, you know, you could turn on your car engine. The inverter is going to put out 800 watts, and you can sit there and recharge a battery for a long time. Because most of the alternatives for decent sized vehicles will give you a kilowatt, maybe a kilowatt and a half peak. So, you know, that's one way of getting it in. We've got some 30 watt solar panels on the east side where we've got our you know, our operations going. There's a lot of the year where there's sun out there. On the west side where I, you know, do some business and you know, have a lot of family. There's a lot of times when that won't, you know, solar isn't going to help you a lot.
Right.
A lot of places wind, you know, will. And so having a, you know, having a 500 watt, you know, wind turbine up in the air, you know, a lot of times, especially on the west side of the mountains in Washington State and in Oregon, when the power is out, it's because the wind kicked up and knocked the trees over under the power line. Well, if the wind is up, that means that your wind turbine is going to be very effective. So that's a nice backup plan. And then, you know, there's if I'm really busy and there's a lot of things to fix, really I'm going to use my small gas generator to recharge it. Just, you know, as long as it's, you know, at the early part of a disaster and I, you know, I've got enough gas stored that I'm worried about the first few days. You know, I won't even, you know, dip into my gasoline that much. And then as I kind of get my world under control, you know, I look at it and say, okay, time to conserve gasoline. Let's get the wood gas going and get my power that way. So there's, you know, distributed power storage and a lot of different ways to get power into them. And then there's also the cheapest energy that, or the most energy that you save is the energy that you don't use.
Yes.
There's, you know, I had a beast of a freezer that had been given to me 20-something years ago, and I'm not sure how old it was at that point, but this is, you know, decades before Energy Star.
Right.
And, yeah. And you know, an 800 watt, you know, 1600 watt peak inverter wasn't going to touch the thing. And so you kind of got to bite the bullet and say, you know, it's doing its job now while power is cheap and available, but this is going to be a big problem under a long power outage. And so I, you know, I spent the money on a really efficient chest freezer that, you know, they can run a week and a half on that one battery bank, and I'm pretty happy with that. Does that kind of go along the lines of what you were talking about?
Yeah, no, that's good. It gave us a lot to think about there, and you know, with storage, with energy storage, and then of course just different solutions altogether. Hey, going back to the gas fire for just a minute, how are some of the ways you can employ it? I mean, what can you run on that? I know you said, you know, you charge your battery bank, and then, but you've also said that, you know, you, needs versus wants. So what are the things that you can run on it?
Well, you know, I would not, some people would classify coffee as a need, but your coffee maker is, you know, 1500 watts, 2000 watts, 3000 watts, depending on what you've got. Use your, you know, your Coleman stove to make your coffee. Don't use your battery bank for that. It's not efficient. Don't light up the whole house. Basically recharge your AA batteries and keep your headlamps going. It takes very, very little power to do that. Those LED things are amazingly efficient. And you're going to, you know, you don't want to use electricity for anything that's heating or doing a lot of lighting, because the energy draw is actually enormous. You want to use it for critical things that are bursty along the lines of refrigeration of your food. It needs a lot of current for a short amount of time to get the compressor spinning, and then that drops down to a few hundred watts, and then that runs for 2 or 3 minutes, and then it turns off for a half an hour, 45 minutes, right? So if you average that out, that's actually not a lot of power that you know, your cooler, your freezer, and your refrigerator are using. Do without your hair dryer. That'd probably be the first thing is lock the hair dryers up and don't let them out until the regular power.
Okay. Good tip.
which, depending on the the mix of your family may cause a war, but it's something that you want to keep away from using this for.
Yeah, absolutely. How about water? Pumping water. Well pumped.
As you read my mind, I was about to go into that. So these wood gas is ideal for carbureted gas engines. People ask me about fuel injected, and we have not gone down that path at all. We're focused on home power generation, and that is, basically carbureted gasoline engines. Diesel engines, lots of people have made some, I know exactly how to do it. I've done it. And it's like, okay, great. That's not our specialty. And I haven't done it. I don't have any plans in the short term to dedicate a diesel engine to seeing whether it'll run with gas. Diesel engines are way expensive compared to gasoline engines. And, you're better off figuring out a way to use, carbureted. So when I say carbureted gas, small gas engines, well, how many things are powered by that? Water pumps for irrigation, snow blowers. We're hoping by the end of the summer to have some video up. My nephews on the farm bought a go-kart that had basically a blown engine that happened to be exactly the engine that we're using for our generators. So they got a really good deal on this thing. And we're going to fabricate, we're in the process of fabricating a little trailer for the thing that holds the gasification system. And so they can just tear around the farm all they want. That will give us some exposure into how does it behave when it's getting kind of jumbled around and shaken.
Right, yeah.
For the ones you find all the plans for, you actually want that because it makes it so you don't have to go back there and use the shaker to move ash and spent fuel out of the way. Basically anything that small gas engines can run can be run on wood gas.
Okay.
And what you have to do is just, the simplest thing, if someone is out there saying, I want to try wood gas, but the whole system is too much for me, but I've got this old engine. Take the whole carburetor off. If you're handy, fabricate a carburetor, which is basically something that'll bolt on there and comes out to two valves. And one valve is for the wood gas coming in, and one valve is for the outside air coming in. And just work on those two valve handles and get the right mix, and that engine will run. It's as simple as that. Now, for us, what we do is we modify the carburetor. The Venturi, where the gas normally comes up liquid, we drill that out and we put the wood gas up there because our wood gas is not liquid. It's a vapor. Not really a vapor, but it's gassy. It's not a liquid. It's less dense than liquid gasoline. So we drill that out and we basically insert that right at the Venturi where the outside air comes across, mixes real good, and goes in the engine. And because we do that, we get to use the throttle control that's built into the carburetor. We get to use the governor that's built into it. There's all kinds of advantages to doing it that way. But if you want to simplify things, what I described earlier is it's good enough to do that.
Very cool.
So basically, anything that you can run on a small gas engine, you can run off wood gas.
Awesome. That's great to know. What's next for your company? I mean, you talked about some of the developments and where you're trying to go with movement, with the gas fire and things like that. Anything else on the horizon?
So one of the things that we're working on now is kind of orthogonal to energy altogether, but something I did for myself and I thought some people would like. When I was in the Marine Corps, my job was to swim up to a beach at night usually it was about 15 Marines, and we would, be in a straight line, and we'd make a hydrographic circle. We'd basically make an underwater topographical map of the beach. And then and we'd log all that information. And then the rest would head out, you know, to the boats. And then four of us would infiltrate the beach, you know, get you know, the lay of the land, where the defenses are, get up onto a hill and stick a HF radio antenna up in the air and call back a, you know, intelligence. And, you know, as the invasion happened, call in close air support, call in naval gunfire, that kind of stuff. And we had no high-tech stuff. When I was in, everything was analog radio, voice, no encryption, at least not in the Marine Corps. I think there were other branches of service that had the budget for the cool stuff, but we didn't. and so we had something we called the bingo card. And it's, you know, when we did it, it was, you know, A, B, C, D down the rows and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 across the columns. And we'd say A5. And you know, on the other end, they would look at A5 on the bingo card. They'd line it up. And in, you know, the column A, row 5, it says, you know, need resupply, send the food packet, the MRE packet. And they say, okay, you know, and at the right time, they fly over our position, and I'd say, execute. And they push the food out, we grab it and run. And I one of the downsides of that was that just human nature, you tend to put things in the same spots. Even if you tried to make them different, you would always use certain letters in certain areas, and you know. So I built a software tool that truly randomizes that, and then adds kind of an extra level of complexity. And it's one of those things that can't be broken as long as you don't use it too often. So it's a little software. What do you call it? We call it the bingo card, but it's a way of obfuscating your message. You know, you and I were at the Rattlesnake Roundup, basically a Patriot event in Western Washington.
Yep.
You know, and the speakers were describing the degree to which religious liberty and liberty in general is being trampled on. You know, and A5. Maybe you know, hide the bastard. You know, and if you've got, you know, you use this tool, it'll scramble. You know, it'll randomize where each of these messages are, and then you print out, and then you close down the program. It doesn't save anything, so no one can get, you know, kind of recreate it again.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be A1 and B2. For ham radio guys like me, I may have antenna types on the rows and power on the columns, and you know, and that's for a case where you need to stay way under the radar. And so I'll get on the radio and I'll be talking to, you know, my brother-in-law in Spokane, you know, from the west side here where I'm currently at, and I'll say, I'm talking to you on the dipole at 30 watts. How's the signal sound? And he'll go to the bingo card and he'll look up dipole and find that row, and he'll look up 30 watts, so find that column, and it says, you know, we need more eggs here. You know, there may be a time when you know, food production is so socialized that you know, it you have this underground market of actually buying food, like in Venezuela, where they can't even get toilet paper. Things are so successful down there that.
Yeah.
So and the nice thing is you're not stuck with the messages that you know, that you can change them all to whatever, you know, applies to you and your group. So anyway, that's a download straight from the website. You know, and then we're looking at, you know, always making process improvements on the wood gas.
Yeah.
You know, right now my wife's really, really into aquaponics. So we're excited about that. I don't think we'll productize that, but that's kind of a fun thing that we're working on right now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Plus you have many means to power those small pumps if the power goes out.
Yeah, they are amazingly efficient. Yeah. My brother-in-law did some research because he does some seed sprouting in order to cut down the cost of feeding the chickens that he has, because they've got
fodder. Fodder. So we use fodder for our chickens and rabbits, actually.
Yeah. So we're and a lot of this is based on feedback from customers. You know, every change that we've made, every product that we've added, except for this software tool for encrypting messages. That's just, you know, I did because I needed it, and then I thought people might like it. Everything is based on customers saying, well, that's neat, but what I really wanted was this, which is similar to what you're doing. Can you do that? And then we can adapt. So we just, that's one of the reasons we love going to the shows is there's nothing like, you know, the free market.
Yes.
The customers will tell you when you're on target and when you're not.
Absolutely. In fact, are you going to be in Yakima next month?
I'm toying with that one. We are looking at the 4th of July Bottom Country event.
Okay.
We are looking at the Spokane Northwest Preparedness Expo. We are discovering that it's not about the number of people, it's about quality.
Yes.
You know, we've gone to Mother Earth News and had, you know, 8,000 people come by every. You know, and sold more stuff at a small event where there's 100 people.
Yeah.
100 serious people, not Mickey Lou's who are bored and thought, oh, let's go check this out. But, you know, people who are living a purposeful life, who are saying, you know, I'm not going to go crazy, but I'm also not going to, you know, go blind. I'm, you know, blindly into the future. I'm gonna put my money where my mouth is. I'm gonna make decisions and buy products that allow me more resilience, more ability to help my neighbor when times are tough.
Absolutely, that's a great way. Why don't we wrap this up? And I want to ask you one more question because I just like to ask people this. What do you think are the most likely challenges or events or things like that that people face and how and what they should be preparing for?
Well, there's a guy who's got a podcast, you know, for a long time that has, you know, one of the things he's really nailed was, you know, don't stress out about the planet, killing meteor, asteroid.
Right. Can't do nothing about that.
Prepare for, you and you losing your job and enough people in your town losing your job where you're not going to be able to get one. You know, prepare for personal emergencies. And a lot of stuff gets cut. I'm in a position where I don't have to worry about feeding my family for a year. I don't have to worry about the power being on. Really at all. Although it'll be much more convenient with the power on, I don't have to worry if it goes off. I basically, my food is not going to go, it's full in the freezer, and I'm going to be able to have, you know, basic electronics, comforts of life. So as far as kind of, with that as a baseline, that, you know, what I think people most should prepare for is personal emergencies. And that means, you know, get yourself out of debt and get yourself some basic, the things in the, have a deep pantry and have some money set aside. That's number one. And regarding kind of nationwide, this financial mess.
Yeah.
I don't think anyway, that no politician is going to take the pain rather than pass on to the next politician the pain of fixing this. So they're going to wait till there's a crisis. There's no alternatives and they have to cut benefits and you know, deal with, with the people that are going to be very angry about that. The things that happen as a result of a currency crisis or just a long, slow degradation of standard of living to people who have really, honestly, in this country, we've lived above our means for decades.
Yeah.
we've had a standard of living that was more than our country's, work and output deserve, and we've done it by accumulating debt. So it's just like your neighbor who lived high on the hog and had, you know, three cars and a big brand new TV every year on credit cards, and then eventually, you know, things go bad. You know, that's gonna happen to us here because we don't have leadership with courage to tell the truth on what needs to happen. And if we did, they would not be elected. The people are not prepared to elect people who will do the right thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with your analysis. I tell people that all the time. It's like stop worrying about, you know, the end of the world, and, you know, prepare, make yourself resilient, be self-sufficient, build community, those kinds of things. That will carry you through any personal emergency or even something greater than that.
Yeah.
How can people get a hold of you and your products?
Okay, so our website is www.tacticalwoodgas.com. And I'm Mike at tacticalwoodgas.com. The main email for getting in orders and such is sales@tacticalwoodgas.com. We've got a bunch of videos up on there. We've got some plans on doing them with higher resolution again this spring. We've got a lot of videos up there. We have a Facebook page with a bunch of videos, most of which are linked to the website, but check out our Facebook page, and we'll put, demonstrations on there. We'll also put fun stuff, you know, the goats, the baby, my brother-in-law had, you know, like 30 baby goats, and they're just the cutest things, and they're bouncing off each other and bouncing off trees.
Oh, yeah.
some fun stuff that's, you know, we don't repost, you know, internet memes generally. We'll just go with, you know, fun stuff that's going on at the farm, or, you know, a new way we figured out how to use a product, or, you know, a customer called and said, hey, I didn't understand your instructions, and so we'll put out a clarification, you know. So, yeah, definitely like us and share our Facebook posts. We would definitely appreciate that help in getting the word out.
Okay, so your Facebook page is Tactical Wood Gas, or?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I missed that. Yeah. Look up Tactical Wood Gas.
Okay.
And Wood Gas is one word. It's not two words. So Wood Gas is one word.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, hey, Mike. Thanks. Thanks a lot for being with us. We appreciate it. That was very helpful. Very informative. If I don't see you in Yakima, I'll probably see you at the other event in north of Spokane there. And yep. Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. Oh, and there's on the website is an 800 number. So if you're
okay.
If you're not an online person, call us on the 800 number. No problem there.
Okay. Yep. See you right there. 1-800-516-4249.
Yep. Perfect.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Mike.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
Our scripture for today comes from Proverbs chapter 29. Verses 1 and 2. He who is often reproved, yet stiffens his neck, will suddenly be broken beyond healing. When the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people groan. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast, Semper Fidelis, and Soli Deo Gloria.